This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Hi, I'm your planet. You might know me from such places as the one you inhabit. I'm the air you breathe and the land on which you're standing. The food that you eat. But I'm getting a little bit dark on some of the ways you treat me.
The climate has changed, we all know that. How can we face the unbearable weight of knowing we did it forever in human terms? You are about to hear one of the best leaders in how to cope without falling into despair. It's the UK psychotherapist Rosemary Randall. We'll follow up with an answer to the industrial food scam with traditional cooking expert Wardy Harmon. I'll pick Wardy's brain on dehydrating food, a green way to preserve nature's best. I'm Alex Smith. Radio EcoShock is serving up the awful truth with a side of answers.
How can we know the time of crisis has arrived? Is the panic heart beating? Or is it only mine?
What if you woke up one morning and realized humans really have changed the world's climate? We show no signs of stopping this unfolding catastrophe. Maybe you already see it and cannot bear knowing. We need help. And a pioneering psychotherapist from Britain says we can help each other. Starting in 2005, Rosemary Randall was part of a team founding a movement called Carbon Conversations. We'll have a conversation with her now. Rosemary Randall, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
I'm glad to connect with you. And before we go into the deep ways our minds cope with loss and climate change, please tell us about Carbon Conversations. What are they?
Carbon Conversations are small groups, six or eight people, who meet with two trained facilitators, people who are skilled in helping a group to work together. They're groups which draw on understandings which come from group psychotherapy, but they're not actually therapy. They use those insights to help people talk about problems which are painful and difficult, which they would like to discuss but find hard to face. So in this case, the problem that people come together to talk about is climate change and carbon reduction. And we started these groups because what I found was that when I talked to people about climate change, they were maybe kind of interested in it, they wanted to know a little bit more, you reached a kind of cutoff point where they started to talk about what they could actually do themselves. And I discovered two things. One was that there was a lot of ignorance about what would actually make a difference, and that when people did understand what might make a difference, their reactions tended to be ones of, well, I can't do that. That's too difficult. I couldn't possibly. That's not for me. I don't see why I should. And things of this kind, things which actually turned away from the problem, again, sometimes because these brought up threats to their identity, threats to their way of life, uncomfortable negotiations to be had with family or friends. And so I started to feel that there was a need for a kind of space where people could begin to both get the understanding that they needed about what would make a difference, but also talk about how it felt to consider making major changes to your life that would align it with what the environment needs, and to talk about why we're doing it, to talk about the very seriousness of the situation we face, which I think is another reason why people often turn away from doing something about it, because they feel every time I take some small action, it just reminds me of why I'm doing it, and that's just so upsetting, I don't want to carry on.
So six or eight people might meet regularly in a room and just talk it through?
We meet for six meetings. So these groups are time limited, and we follow a program of looking at the different areas of your carbon emissions and the big issues around climate change. And we talk about what it feels to think about, well, you might make a load of changes to your home, very personal thing, how you have your home. And we talk about what it might mean if you decide that you're not going to fly again, or if you're going to give up your car use, or you're going to try and reduce it. We look at what you do with your food. What would it mean if you decided that you were going to eat a lot less meat, for example? And we look at all the rest of your consumption. What would it mean to live a much lower consumption lifestyle? And there are a lot of complicated issues in there. which have a lot of personal ramifications for people. And so those are the things which we begin to talk about. Because often there's a feeling of, there's feelings of loss involved, there's grief, there's a feeling that of having been let down by government, there are feelings of being very small and what difference can I make? And I think that it's only when these things begin to be talked about that people begin to be able to feel that they may have the support that will enable them to take difficult decisions in their own personal lives. You know, we hope that government are going to act. We hope that policies will change. That's only part of the picture. Our lives have to change as well.
And how do these people who are worried about climate change find each other in order to form the groups?
Initially, when I started this in Cambridge in England, we started a small voluntary organization. And across the UK, there are a lot of small voluntary organizations working on climate change, community groups like the Transition Town groups, which you may have come across, and other groups, they call themselves things like, you know, such and such climate change action group or whatever. So those groups are gathering members together, and often they're looking for ways to work with those members, ways of supporting and helping people. And that's where these carbon conversations groups come in. They're one of the things which a group like that might choose to do. And we're also using the groups increasingly in workplaces where we have big organizations sometimes who are wanting to do something to become more sustainable. They maybe got government targets to meet and they've realized that they need to have their employees on board. And so we've been offering these groups as a tool which people can use within workplaces as well. And the reason that they seem to work is that they are not just talking about, well, you should do this and you should do that, or here are the top 10 tips to reduce your impact on the climate. They're actually talking about what it means in your life to be thinking about these issues and to be trying to do something about it, and what it means to actually maybe take actions that make you stand out against your friends or your family or colleagues.
So, Rosemary Randall, let's talk about loss. What do people say they fear or experience as climate change unfolds?
I think that very often people don't talk very much about loss. I think that it's something which emerges as you start to create a space that feels safe enough to talk about it. So very often in these groups, it may be the second or third meeting before somebody really mentions loss. And sometimes it may be about something quite funny or something a little bit surprising. Because although I think everybody will have these serious conversations where they will talk about the way that they notice things changing, they notice things which are different. Older people will say, well, there don't seem to be so many birds in my garden. I'm aware of this and I feel very sad about it. So people will begin to talk about those sorts of losses. But they will also begin to talk about being confronted with loss as they try to make a transition. And so somebody in a group recently said to me, in astonishment, because she hadn't realized that dairy produce has a very, very high impact on the environment. And she said, what? No cheese? I can't eat cheese. I'm really upset. That's a loss for me. And she was laughing. But she was also quite serious because she was thinking, well, I really like this stuff, this cheese. It is a loss. And it was kind of like to be given permission to say that she didn't really want to give up cheese. She was kind of fighting it. And she needed to come to some negotiation, some accommodation, like less cheese. But in experiencing something very small like that as loss, I think allows you to go past it. So there are the big losses, which I think we see in climate change when we think about loss of species and loss of habitat and loss of many of the very, very deeply beautiful and sustaining things about our world. And there are the kind of day-to-day losses that we might face when we decide that we're going to keep the house a few degrees cooler, or we're going to say no to the hen night in Prague, or we're going to maybe not buy quite so many new clothes this year, whatever it is. There are those losses too, and they need to be worked through.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with my guest from the UK, psychotherapist Rosemary Randall. Ro, a listener sent me a link to a really important paper you wrote in 2009. It's titled Loss and Climate Change, The Cost of Parallel Narratives. That's posted at conservation-economy.org. I'll put a link to it in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. Can you explain what you mean by the danger of parallel narratives about climate change?
I wrote this paper at a point at which I was very, very struck by the way in which, when climate change itself was talked about, it was in terms of catastrophe. It was melting ice caps. It was hugely rising sea levels. It was New York being underwater. It was kind of act now or we face disaster. And this was a very powerful narrative which I was hearing sometimes from government and sometimes from environmental organizations. As if by telling us more and more and more about the catastrophe, we would wake up and do something. And parallel to that, I was noticing that when people said, well, what do I do then? That the things which they were asking to do were, being asked to do, were absolutely minimal. It was like, well, perhaps you could change a couple of light bulbs. And I identified a number of different narratives which I thought were being used, which I gave a number of different names to. One was this idea of the small steps, or just do something little. The other was the idea that we would pass seamlessly from our current way of life into a new one. Third one was the idea that technology will save us. You don't need to do anything because the professors are going to sort it out with their magic. And another one was the idea that actually there was going to be changes, but we were going to feel fine about it. It was going to be a much happier way of life. And I felt that none of these narratives were commensurate with the disaster stories that we were hearing. And what it felt to me was as if, in a way, we had created these opposites, this sort of terrifying world in the future and this bland and reassuring one now. And so that all the losses had been pushed into the future as a sort of what if, this will happen if you don't act. And all the things that would actually stop it, the big things that would stop it, that we might need to take responsibility, had been eliminated from the picture. And so we had these sort of parallel tracks which didn't really connect. And I came to think that the connecting factor was about loss, that the fact is that dealing with climate change involves us giving up the way of life that we currently have. And nobody was really prepared to say that. But actually, we live utterly unsustainable lives. We have to start taking them apart now, and we're probably not going to like having to do it. And, you know, most people will kick at that. And so I felt that if you do actually start to make those changes, it turns out to be not as bad as you thought. You can manage those transitions. You can let go of the things which you have wanted and which you have enjoyed, which really no longer deserve a place in life. And so I felt that we needed somehow to look at models which helped us understand what the process of going through a loss and coming to terms with it actually is.
Well, I think, you know, millions of people are quietly realizing the weather has changed. They may see that the robins or a finch doesn't come back. And just like your cheese incident there, it strikes them. Well, then we might have a first stage of a personal crisis of realization. How can we deal with that?
Okay, so one of the things I think that happens in the model which I use in this paper, which I take from William Morden, is that the first reaction to a loss is to say, it can't be true. Perhaps the robin's just hiding. Perhaps it's going to come tomorrow. Things like that. Or you could deny the meaning of the loss. You can say to yourself, well, there aren't any robins in the garden, but that doesn't necessarily mean that everything's gone wrong. It's just a variable year. Or you can say to yourself, you can deny that the loss is irreversible. You can say to yourself, well, there aren't any robins, but I'm sure there'll be some robins next year. And so you can kind of hold yourself away from it. And the difficult thing, I think, the first thing you have to do is actually say, no, actually, there isn't a robin in the garden this year, and it is probably something to do with the loss of biodiversity, because I do know that the population of robins is plummeting, or whatever it is. And first of all, you have to accept that idea intellectually. You know, it's a fact, and then in a way, you have to begin to accept it emotionally. You have to say, well, actually, I care about this. It matters to me. And I think a lot of people get stuck is in this first area of denial, which I think you'll notice is not really like the denial when we talk about the denial of a climate change skeptic or somebody who just says, oh, climate change ain't happening. This is a very ordinary form of denial that probably most of us are engaged in at one level or another because the facts are so painful. It's just very, you know, in a way it's very normal to try to hide in those places. And coming through that, I think what William Warden talks about is he talks about really these two paths of grief. He talks about the tasks of grief. And you can either, in a way, work through these painful emotions. You can realize that you feel grief. You can have moments of despair. You can feel afraid. You may feel very guilty about the way that you feel at fault because of it. You may feel sad. You may yearn for the things which are lost. You may feel that your life is very confused and so on. And you can come out of that into a new adjustment in which you feel that you've got new skills and you develop a changed sense of self and you can reinvest your emotional energy. And that's the positive pathway through grief that he talks about. And he talks about it in a way not as a complete and ever finished process. You know, you have kind of all sorts of setbacks. But what he identifies as what he calls the negative of that process is a state where, because this feels so painful, you shut off all emotion. You maybe idealize what is lost. You try to numb the pain, maybe through alcohol or drugs or manic activity. And one of the manic activities which you might indulge in, for instance, is going shopping. Lots and lots of going shopping, for example. And you don't adapt to the changed situation that you find yourself in. And the longer-term outcome of that is bitterness, anger, depression, withdrawal, and a sense of turning away from life. I think it's quite a useful model for thinking about what we maybe need to go through because it offers us a way of understanding the different places that people may be at and then perhaps allows us to have sympathy for those experiences.
Well, listeners, I want to tell you that you can find Rosemary's adaptation of William Warden and others in that article, Loss and Climate Change, The Cost of Parallel Narratives, on page 8. And there's a chart of 4 stages with the possibility of successful coping or destructive failure at each stage. But Rosemary, I can't tell you how many friends and listeners have fallen back on the model of coping with the ultimate loss of death developed by Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. Does that work well for the end of a loved and stable climate?
I think the use of Kubler-Ross is really interesting. I mean, she was such a pioneer. Her work was mainly with people who were themselves dying. And so the loss that they faced was the loss of their own life. And coming to terms with that and its finality and the little tiny amount of time that you have left. And she was a terrific person because she opened up the possibility of talking about things which had been unspeakable. But I think where William Warden's work is important is that he draws on the work of other people like Colin Murray Parks and John Bowlby to actually look at the experience of loss when you are going to carry on living and you are losing somebody else who is dear to you or you are losing something else that you will not have back. And so I think it's kind of helpful in looking at things which we might also think of as transitions. So in some ways, life is full of little losses. Somebody once referred to the death of a pet as one of life's little rehearsals, in that it kind of prepares you for bigger and harder losses later on. So that whether you're looking at the transition from, say, childhood into adolescence or from middle age into old age, there you're sometimes looking at letting go of something in order to move forward. Or in the cases of the loss of somebody you've loved in life, you're looking at how you're going to cope with the new situation. And I think in Kubler-Ross's model, because Kubler-Ross's model ends with death, and I think for us, we're looking hopefully at moving on and being able to do more. So I think that's why I started using William Warden's model. I felt it has more hope in it.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. You know, we have the guilt of our own participation in damaging the atmosphere, but now I feel like I'm experiencing a new wrinkle. When I feel down or discouraged, I ask myself, am I just assimilating this awful truth about climate change? It's almost like that fear of nuclear destruction that I grew up with during the Cold War. Do you see a parallel between climate fear and nuclear fear?
I do. I think that. I mean, I think that's very perceptive. I think that they both produce this huge anxiety because it hangs over you, and you can go through big chunks of the day, I think, sometimes carrying on just as normal. I think just as in those experiences of the nuclear threat, a lot of the time nothing seemed very different, and then you'd kind of wake up in the middle of the night, or you'd catch something in the newspaper, and it would just kind of grab you in the guts that everything could come to an end with a sort of terrible, terrible finality. And I think sometimes there are so many unknowns about climate change. We know that it's happening, but we don't know exactly how it's going to work out. It's very difficult for anybody to tell us. It's a situation which makes people feel very, very unsafe. I do think there is a parallel there, which for me, I think it comes down to trying to find the things which will make me feel okay about living day to day, enjoying the things which still matter, whether it's, you know, a hug from a child, or whether it's planting the first seeds in my garden, whether it's just looking up at the sky, or looking out of my window at the moment and seeing two pigeons doing acrobatics on my bird table. They're much too big for it, so they're really quite funny. Holding on to some of those things in the face of fear and grief, I think, is really important.
Yes, I think it's part of my job to find some joy every day and really focus on it, just take it in and use it because I need it. Well, making this harder is the isolation we talked about at the beginning with carbon conversations. My friends and relatives are deciding on a new car or a trip to Thailand or whether to take a lucrative job in the oil industry. Daily life goes on as advertised. Are we the crazy ones to believe what science is telling us?
Or are we the canaries in the mine? Are we the ones who are singing and singing loudly? I think this experience of seeing daily life carry on around you is an extremely painful one. And I think there is sometimes the experience of having projected into you other people's guilt. So being seen as the awkward person who will always bring climate change up. So people deny their own concern, their own guilt, their own experience of the issue, and they place it in you and expect you, in a way, to speak it for them so they can then attack it in you. And so I think the role of the person who has woken up to this and is speaking about it and trying to hold conversations about it is a very, very difficult one. And in some ways, one of the things I always say to people when they find themselves in these tricky conversations is that the first thing you really have to do is to listen. Because I think when you listen to the force with which people talk to you about their new car or their trip to Thailand, in some ways I'm listening for what I can say that is not going to create a confrontation, but how I can actually still be true to myself in that discussion. And sometimes that's hard. You know, I might say something like, wow, you're going to Thailand, that's amazing. How much longer do you think, you know, people like us are going to be able to carry on doing that? You know, I try not to give up on my own position, but I try not to get confrontational.
You know, that's exactly the question and reply that I got from another listener of Radio EcoShock, who said to someone who's flying off to Brazil, I think it was for a wedding or something, to say, well, how much longer do you think we can keep doing that? And they were quite surprised. Well, is the airline industry going broke? Well, no, it's the fact that everything's changing and Brazil may lose the rainforest. Well, now, as for yourself, Rosemary Randall, you've moved on from the movement you helped found, Carbon Conversations. What are you doing now?
Well, I'm actually still working with Carbon Conversations. The little organization in Cambridge, which I set up to work on environmental issues, that I have moved on from. But the national organization, which is supporting Carbon Conversations, I'm still involved with. I'm still training facilitators. I'm involved with another grouping in the UK called the Climate Psychology Alliance, which is trying to work more widely with bringing psychological understanding into work on climate change. Really just trying to work with whoever we can around why this is actually such a painful and difficult experience. No one likes to hear bad news, and sadly, an awful lot of climate change is bad news. So I think that psychology has a lot to say about it.
And is there something that I've missed that you would like to talk about?
It's been great talking to you, Alex. You've been a fantastic listener. One of the things which psychotherapy is all about is about listening to people, trying to hear where they're coming from, what it is that they want to say, and making the space for them to do so. And you've done it brilliantly.
Well, thank you. Well, I think, you know, my Radio EcoShock listeners are in the same position. They give us this space each week to really talk with some very brilliant people and find out, you know, what is going on. Well, as we wrap up, I'd like to ask you maybe the impossible. I feel like I've caused some Radio EcoShock listeners to worry. I've been the bearer of some really bad news about the Arctic and deserts and storms. I'm wondering, can you offer us one or two good tips to cope, to keep going?
I think one of the things which has mattered most to me is knowing who I speak to about these things and how I talk about it. And to know that there are people in my life who I share this with. To know that I'm not the only person who goes through times of often very black despair about what is happening. And I think knowing also that I'm one person and I'm doing what I can and to value what I do and to feel that even if we don't succeed in the way that I wish we could, that it's a question of ethics. It's a question of living the life that I want to lead, leading the life that I think I should lead, the life that feels an ethical life to me. So I think in some ways where I find strength is in partly coming back to those core values that I hold that matter to me. I would do this anyway, regardless of whether we're going to succeed or not. And for me, that's very important. And the other thing is to do it with others, to do it in the company of others with whom you can talk, with whom you can say, I'm having a very bad day about this today. What should we do about it? And to find myself also, I think, often outside, in touch with the rest of the natural world. Today I happen to be laughing at the pigeons, but another day it might be that I'm out for a walk, I've gone to the sea, I'm just staring up at the way the clouds form patterns, and I can find a sense of peace again.
Yes, I find myself talking to trees occasionally. I'm not sure how good that is, but it works for me. Well, our guest has been the British psychotherapist and co-founder of the Carbon Conservation Movement, Rosemary Randall. Find out more at carbonconversations.org, and you can follow Ro Randall at her blog at rorandall.org, and that's R-O, and there's two L's in Randall. Rosemary, thank you so much for helping us out today.
Great to talk to you, Alex. Thank you very much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. A special thanks to those who supported the broadcast this week. That will help me attend the Mother Earth News Fair in Puyallup, Washington, at the start of June to get a lot of how-to interviews for you. This spring, you will hear fundraising appeals from your local nonprofit station. Please, please support your local radio station with a good donation. You know print media is floundering. TV has totally sold out to the big corporate machine and they're losing viewers. Nonprofit radio is one of the last stands of advertising free speech. I count on you to put your money where your ears are by supporting your nonprofit radio station.
Time has been wasted so much. Precious time, all this frustration eating away at your sanity, yeah. Living in the seeds of your past, living in the seeds of your past.
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
It's shocking so many city folks say they are not interested in cooking or preserving food. Don't they eat? Don't they read the headlines about toxic factory agriculture and fast food restaurants? The awful wave of food-related diseases like diabetes, heart attacks, strokes, obesity, and colon cancer could be the result. Plus, we can save a lot of money and tons of greenhouse gas emissions when we grab food cheap when it's fresh, putting it away for times to come. One of the easiest and best ways to store food is dehydrating. Humans have been doing it for thousands of years. You can too. Our guest, Wardy Harmon, lives in rural Oregon. She serves up a wide variety of cooking and preserving courses online from the mysteriously named Gnalfglens.com. We're going to get some good tips from Wardy about drying food. Wardy Harmon, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you so much, Alex. I'm happy to be here.
I feel like I know you a little bit from your online videos. As we start, my wife wants to know, what do you mean by traditional cooking?
Sure. Well, starting in the early 1900s, food started being mass-produced and the food industry started taking shape. And so that's more like modern food preparation methods. And traditional methods were the way people prepared and served and preserved food prior to the food industry coming on the scene. So it'd be things like sourdough instead of quick yeasted bread, you know, cultured butter, making butter, those kind of traditional food preparation skills.
Well, before we lose half our listeners, I'm hoping more men will get involved in cooking and preserving food. The health statistics clearly show our diets are worse and we die younger. Wardy, can we get more men back into this food dialogue and into the kitchen? Are you seeing them come for your courses?
I am, and it is so wonderful. Of course, you have shown an interest recently, but there are men who are interested in sourdough or making cheese. We get, of course, not as many men, but they are there, and I'm always thrilled and delighted to see them and interact with them.
And how did you get started in all this?
Well, that's a great question. My children are now ages 12 to 16, but when they were born and in the early years, they had food allergies, and we just worked around the food allergies. But I was introduced to the concept of traditional cooking and traditional foods through the book Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon. And one of the ideas in that book was that if we prepare our foods differently, they may be easier for us to digest and we may get more nutrition from them. And so implementing those methods like soaking, sprouting, fermenting made all the difference. And my children were then able to eat foods that they previously couldn't eat because the foods were prepared better and also their digestive system was kind of given a break. And it was really miraculous, and we just loved that process. And so then I began teaching and sharing about it because, you know, it's life-changing information.
Yeah, well, I could see a lot of applications for that. Sometimes as people get older, they can't digest food as well either. And so knowing how to prepare food properly could be helpful there. And people don't chew their food properly anymore. They just pour it straight down their throats. So all these food preparation tips can help with that. Well, let's make the best use of our time. I want to get straight to food dehydration. Why would we choose drying food instead of canning it or freezing?
Well, there's so many reasons to consider dehydrating, and one of the primary ones is that it's very traditional. It is the oldest method of food preservation we have. Probably second older is fermentation. And both of those methods preserve or enhance the nutrition of foods. Canning, you lose nutrition when you can. Freezing requires electricity. So dehydrating is kind of like, oh, just so ideal. Your food takes up less space. It's less susceptible to spoiling because the moisture has been removed. The nutrition is preserved, so you've got enzymes and vitamins that aren't destroyed through high heat cooking. It's very portable, so if you don't have cold storage, you want to not rely on freezers. It's just the way to go for many, many reasons.
Plus, we hope there won't be a big emergency like a power outage, but we've had them here, and then, of course, you can lose everything that's in your freezer, so that's another reason, too. Moving on, what are the main choices when it comes to selecting a food dehydrator?
Food dehydrators have two basic ways that they work, and it has to do with the way the air flows. So you'll have dehydrators that may flow from horizontally, like front to back or side to side. You'll have dehydrators where the airflow is vertical, so either the fan's on the bottom or the fan's on the top. And my personal choice is the fan, so the air movement is side to side or horizontal. You get even drying of foods. You don't get mingling of flavors. And then additional considerations on top of that would be the shape of the dehydrator. My dehydrator of choice is the Excalibur, which has square trays. More economical dehydrators have circular trays, and they work great. They do, but you don't get as efficient usage of space because a circular shape is, you know, harder to maximize on space. And then, of course, if you're not wanting to go the electric route at all, you have the sun, which is the way foods were dehydrated since time gone by. You have sun or warmth, really, and then you have circulating air. So you can suspend foods high over a smoky fire. You can put window screen trays out in the sun and make sure there's airflow. You can construct a solar dehydrator where the way it's designed, the air is flowing through and moving the warm air past the food, pulling the moisture out, and it just dries. So there's kind of a lot of things. I have a friend who actually doesn't have a dehydrator and has turned her car into a dehydrator. So she has a lot of space, and she fills it up when fruit's in season with all these trays of fruit leather or cut-up fruit. So, you know, because it's an old method, you don't have to get really technical. But if you have the convenience of choosing an electric dehydrator, then you can look at those options.
They are handy because they're sitting right on the counter where you are, and some of us don't have the room to build an extra outbuilding to dry foods, as some of these solar hydrators look like a little outhouse almost with a ramp up to them. But I think that solar food dryer should be our ultimate goal if we have the right climate for it, and not everybody does. I don't know. How did it work for you in Oregon?
Yeah, I don't think it's a good candidate for us in Oregon. We have friends who tried it, and we have such rainy, moist weather much of the year that food spoils rather than dries. So it's not good for us here. But, you know, someday we relocate to a drier climate, sunnier climate, I think it would be a great candidate. Climate is definitely an issue with that.
Well, Wardy Harmon, why is the drying temperature so important?
Good question. Yes, and this is one of the reasons that I love drying over canning, for instance, because you can really tailor the temperature to preserve the nutrition of food. And so foods that have enzymes and vitamins, you don't want to overheat them. You want to dehydrate them at, say, 115 degrees Fahrenheit or less, because that's kind of the threshold for raw cooking or, you know, the viability of raw foods. So that's what I choose, like for sprouted grains or fruits and vegetables that I'm not going to end up cooking, but we just want to eat raw. And then, of course, your dehydrator can go higher. Let's say you're making instant rice or instant beans. It's something that's already cooked. It's going to be in a cooked dish. Well, then you can go higher on the temperature because you're not trying to preserve the enzymes and vitamins. But then again, it's not super high heat to denature the food or to discolor the food. That's why I love dehydrating, is you can really decide the optimum temperature for the goal you have in mind for your food rather than all raw or all heated really hot. You can adjust and be flexible.
And what about herbs, drying herbs for the kitchen?
Yes, and herbs, they should be even lower because of their volatile compounds. So, you know, do herbs at like 95 or 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and then you'll preserve their color, you'll preserve their nutrition, especially those medicinal qualities of the herbs.
Once we have the food ready, it takes a little preparation for success, though. Can you give us some examples, including maybe your blueberry predicament?
Yes, you brought up my adventure, yes. Well, we've got a number of pre-treatments you want to do for foods, and they involve the simple things like peeling or seeding or shredding or chopping, you know, and you can kind of look at a food like a banana, you know, obviously you're going to peel it, or a peach, obviously you're going to take the pit out. Then there's kind of more advanced pre-treatments that you just learn by reading or by time, and they involve things like steaming or blanching a food to preserve the color. And in the case of blueberries, it's called checking. And the blueberry has this, like, watertight skin. And when you dry, you know, if you just put in the dehydrate, it would just, like, tend to puff up like a balloon and not dry efficiently. So you want to break the skin so the warm air can penetrate and it can dry efficiently. Well, Alex, you're bringing up last summer when I had all these local blueberries and I read different methods, and one lady was talking about how I just put them on the dehydrator and it worked just fine. So, you know, me, I like to do things as efficiently as possible and, you know, not spend time on something that's not necessary. So I threw them in the dehydrator and they took a full week to dry. I guess I had really thicker skinned blueberries than hers. So I learned the hard way to either submerge in hot water until the skins pop, or you can take a pin and you can prick the skins, or you can freeze, actually, because freezing will change the skin. And so that's an example of a pre-treatment, and it's just you learn. And pre-treatments, they're important. And, of course, as you mentioned, my online classes, I discuss all the pre-treatments. And as we go through different food groups, we talk about, you know, for blueberries and cranberries, you want to do this. For green vegetables, like green beans, you want to blanch them to preserve the color and things like that.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We're talking about preserving the best of nature's good food in season with the online cooking course teacher, blogger, and broadcaster, Wardy Harmon. Well, you've talked about preparing the food, but I also noticed from your course that you measure what goes in and what comes out, and you write that down in a log. Why do you do that?
Sure, I do, because I don't intend for my dried foods to sit on the shelf, and when I go to make a recipe and use them, I don't want to have to rely on my memory or somebody else's experience, although other people's experience is great. But if I have it written down, my concept is measure on, measure off. So if I have it written down that I diced one onion and then I measured it when it came off, then I know exactly how much onions to use in a recipe that's calling for one diced onion. Well, now I know what that yielded when I dried it. So I find it just really, really helpful to have those yields handy in my dehydrating log, so when I go to cook with the foods, there's no guesswork and my memory is bad. So then I have it and I know what to use.
Well, I have the same memory problems, especially when we're doing something that we're maybe just doing once a year with each food as it comes along. It's hard to remember the next year what worked and what didn't.
Yes, good point. If it turned out really good and you're coming up on blueberry season again, and or if it turned out really bad, then your notes tell you what you did and how it turned out, and then you can adjust or do the same.
And I'm surprised at the number of wet foods that you dry. People wouldn't think about this for dehydrating. I mean, you talk about drying broth, for example. Won't that pour all over the inside of the food dehydrator? How do you handle it?
Well, yes. With broth, the pre-treatment we're going to do is actually to reduce it and or add gelatin. So then it's thick from reduction or it's thick from being gelled. And then you can spread it easily and it's not going to fall all over that tray.
Can we dry dairy or egg products ourselves?
Yes, I do, and it works great. I don't dry plain raw milk. What I do is dry, or plain milk, I should say, in case your listeners are not raw milk enthusiasts like I am. But what I tend to do is cultured milk. So I would have kefir or I'd have yogurt, and I would actually turn it into a cheese. So dripping it through cheesecloth removes, the whey and a lot of the liquid just through that kind of preparatory treatment. And then you've got this paste, like a soft cheese spread on your trays. It's really easy. Eggs, don't do anything special except whip them up, and they are this thick mixture. You can't put a ton on each tray. I'd have to refer to my notes exactly, but, you're looking at 2 or 3 eggs per dehydrator tray, or they will roll off.
Okay. And we've got all these good foods dried. Now, how do we store them for maximum shelf life and safety?
Well, the rules of thumb for storing dried foods is really the rules of thumb that you'd use to store your rice or your beans or, dry goods. So you're removing moisture as much as possible, and you do that by fully drying the foods. But you also do that by sealing them up tight. So you can do that with vacuum seal or Mylar bags and oxygen absorbers. You're also removing oxygen, and you accomplish that through a vacuum seal or through using oxygen absorbers in a jar or in combination with a Mylar bag. And you also want to keep the temperature even and optimally around 60 degrees Fahrenheit. Now, we can't always achieve that. And fourth, you want to keep your things dark. So for me, the absolutes is completely dry and removing oxygen. If you can't store at 60 degrees, you can store at room temperature. And most dried goods, you would have a shelf life of at least a year at room temperature. And dark, I accomplished that behind a curtain on my storage shelves. If you do optimal, there's a lot of foods that will store for 5, 10, 25 years. It's a marvelous method of food preservation, because if you dry the foods well and then you store them well, you're basically removing all those things that mess with food and spoil it. The moisture, the oxygen, bugs, light, and heat. And that comes in handy, whether we're preparing for a rainy day or a disaster or survival situation. The better we can store our foods, the more handy they will be in the event that they're needed.
Well, and also there can be crop failures, or the prices of something are just double 1 year what they were the year before. And if you've got it put away, then you can pull it out and your household economy is still okay. Well, once we've got these things ready, they're on the shelf or wherever they are, now we're going to have to rehydrate some things. What do we need to think about there?
Well, I actually advise that people think about how they want to use their dried foods before they ever dry them. Because the method you choose for drying, like if you chop it or shred it or dice it or puree it, your intended use affects your method. So like, for instance, let's say you do a lot of zucchini bread. Well, shred your zucchini and dry it shredded. Or let's say you do a lot of diced onions. Well, dice your onions and then dry them. Let's say you just want to do steamed green beans. Well, then you're just going to break your green beans into 1 to 2 inch pieces. You go through all those, you know, how am I going to use this? And that affects how you dry them, the pieces you dry them in. I probably can't cover all the bases here, but let's talk about that shredded zucchini. So if you're going to use it in a zucchini bread, you could just soak it in water for 5 to 15 minutes till it plumps up, and then drain it, and then toss it into your batter, and then bake your bread. Or let's say you're going to add it to a crockpot soup. Well, the soup has sufficient liquid, so actually all you have to do is toss those dried zucchini pieces right in the crock pot with all the juices and, you know, whatever's going, and there's enough to plump it right as it's cooking. What's another example? Like, let's say you've dried whole beans. You get dry beans, but I'm not talking about that kind of dry beans. I'm saying you get the dry beans, you soak them, you cook them, then you dry them, so you've got, like, instant whole beans, and they will plump up in hot water in 30 minutes. So if you know you do a lot of soups or stews or casseroles with whole beans, and you just dry them whole, you can plump them up, you can add them to a dish, or like the crock pot example I told before, if you have a soup going in the crock pot with lots of liquid, just put your dried beans that have already been pre-cooked and dried in the crock pot, and they'll plump up while it's cooking. And the same principle applies to like homemade instant rice. Boy, there's so many more examples I could share, but that's basically what you want to think of before you dry is, how am I going to use this food? Dry it that way in the form that makes it useful to you. And then reconstituting usually is as simple as soaking in water or simmering. Some foods need to be simmered to reconstitute, or tossing in a dish that has sufficient liquid so that as it cooks, the food plumps up.
So all these details are in your online traditional cooking courses that you offer at traditionalcookingschool.com. Tell us just a little bit about how those courses work.
Well, we have 7 classes, actually, and, you know, you and I today are talking about dehydrating, which is the 7th, the one that we're building up currently. And how it works is we have a private member area, and members get access to all the classes to go through at their leisure. They're not delivered, you know, over time. Basically, as a member, you access everything that we've already released. Now, my little brief disclaimer here is that we are currently working on dehydrating, so not all the dehydrating lessons are available yet, because they're still in production. But more than half of dehydrating is available and the other 6 courses. And as a member, you log in and you browse the lessons, the classes. There's videos in each lesson. There's print tutorials to download with more detail. Some lessons have audio files. There's a forum to go along with it to give support if you have questions, but also we encourage feedback because it's wonderful to visit with people about what they're doing and trying. Basically, that's how it works.
Well, you've collected a lot of skills. What helped you, and what resources or books do you recommend?
Yes. Well, the one I already mentioned, Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon, is really what got me started. And really the reason I started teaching online was because I talked to people who said, yeah, I know about Nourishing Traditions, but I just find it so overwhelming, I don't know where to start. So, you know, my first class was actually the fundamentals of traditional cooking, and it just pulled out the key preparations and made them available to people to break it out in chunks. And I think my slogan at the time was, master traditional cooking skills 1 week at a time, because that's what I advise that people do, is this week learn about soaking, this week learn about sprouting, next week learn how to do your beans, next week learn how to make kefir. Boy, Nourishing Traditions is my go-to resource. I have other resources like on homesteading, like we have the Encyclopedia of Country Living. I have some basic cheese books, but it's by Margaret Morris. It's, I think, the Home Cheesemaker's Manual.
At this point, I want to thank my own source for this interview. I first heard Wardy Harmon on the Get Real, Get Prepared radio show with Vicki Lynn Haycraft from realfoodliving.com. That was a great show, Vicki Lynn. And Wardy, you have your own show on the Preparedness Radio Network, do you?
Yes, I do. It's called Know Your Food with Wardy, and it airs every Friday at 6 a.m. Central. So you can find that at BePreparedRadio.com.
Well, I know with Radio EcoShock, I get many of my best tips and suggestions from listeners. Are you still learning from your members in those discussion forums on your site?
Oh, I do. They are amazing and wonderful. One of the things I try to do with each lesson is encourage people to come on by the forum after they're done with a lesson and just share what they're learning. And I love hearing it. I love hearing what they're doing with foods. and I take notes. I don't know if people realize that, but I note things. And I try to bring in what I learn from people as often as I can and, of course, credit them because it's really a community effort.
Well, wrapping it up, what is Gnalfglens? Tell us what that is and tell us how people find your website and your blog.
Yes, Gnalfglens is my main site, gnalfglens.com. It's an acronym, and it stands for God's Natural Organic Whole Foods Grown Locally in Season. So those letters are GNOWFGLINS. And it basically stands for the ideals of food that I and my family strive to incorporate in our eating, and we do it for God's glory. We really do. We don't do it because it's a rule or a have to. We do it because we recognize that God designed nutrition in our foods, and we really strive after those foods. And the acronym tells you the kinds of foods that we think are the best. An easy way to get to Gnalfglens.com, if you're yet unfamiliar with the spelling or your fingers aren't used to typing it in, is to go to traditionalcookingschool.com. You could also find us on YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, all of which use the handle Gnalfglens.
Well, listeners, as always, I'll put links for this interview in my own show blog at ecoshock.info. If you missed any of that, you can check right up. And the food dehydrating and canning season starts right now, really. The asparagus and rhubarb are starting to come into the markets at seasonal low prices. My area, rhubarb costs $2.50 a pound in the spring compared to $5 a pound late in the fall and winter. It's half price for anyone who's ready to preserve these natural foods. Wardy, do you find yourself shoving things into the food dryer almost throughout the year?
Yes, I do. I just think about what's in season and how many more trays I can fill up. So yes, I might go out to the garden and cut some herbs because I have a couple trays left over, or we might have some extra apples, or I might have a pot of rice and we only ate half of it, so I'll fill a couple trays with rice and that makes instant rice. I also purposefully cook big batches of things like beans or maybe a whole ham and then dice up and dry half of it. So yes, the food dehydrator is always going and I'm always trying to fill it.
Well, so there's less food waste and you're ready if you're busy later. TraditionalCookingSchool.com, Wardy Harmon, thank you so much for sharing with us.
Thank you so much, Alex. It was a treat.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
I asked Wardy Harmon what she meant by traditional cooking. There is more to it. Wardy credits Sally Fallon, co-author of the influential 1989 book, Nourishing Traditions, the cookbook that challenges politically correct nutrition and diet dictocrats. Sally and co-author Mary G. Enig co-founded the Weston A. Price Foundation. According to Wikipedia, Weston Price was, quote, a dentist from Cleveland, Ohio, whose 1939 book, Nutritional and Physical Degeneration, describes the fieldwork he did in the 1920s and 1930s. Among various world cultures, with the original goal of recording and studying the dental health and development of pre-industrial populations, including tribal Africans, Pacific Islanders, Inuit, North and South American natives, and Australian Aborigines, end quote, from Wikipedia. From my blog at ecoshock.info, you can find a link to watch a YouTube of Sally Fallon explaining how Weston Price judged a person's general health by the condition of their teeth. He visited pre-industrial people and concluded their diets were the main reason their teeth were generally better formed, with fewer cavities than people living in Western countries. The science behind the writing comes from the other major player in the Weston A. Price Foundation, nutritionist Mary G. Enig. She's the real deal, with a Ph.D. in nutritional sciences, experience in research labs, and published scientific papers. However, Enig's theory of the benefits of fatty foods, including butter and coconut oil, and her contrarian views that cholesterol does not lead to heart disease, has earned her criticism from other scientists. Dr. Joel Furman is very critical of the Fallon Price diet recommendations for meat and fats, especially the Price Foundation suggestion that high cholesterol may be good for us. Fallon and Enig also take up Weston Price's promotion of fermented foods used by many ancient cultures as an aid to full digestion of both plant and animal products. You may think of sauerkraut, but there's a whole universe of fermented foods out there. Our guest Wardy Harmon has a new book out on it, The Complete Idiot's Guide to Fermenting Foods. I know little about this, and Wardy has promised to send me a copy. I'll let you know if I try out some of her recipes. Sally Fallon has a devastating critique of soy products, especially soy milk. You may think it's healthy and organic, but you better hear what she has to say about it. The Weston A. Price Foundation lobbies against the use of soy formula for infants. My opinion is she's right about this. Both Fallon and Enig are major forces behind the push to legalize raw milk. They claim pasteurization kills off beneficial nutrients and reduces our immunity. Personally, I just don't know enough to judge these claims. It's my opinion, and nothing more than an opinion, that most mammals stop drinking milk as they mature, and probably we should too. Wardy says the Bible talks about milk drinking, and that's an authority for her, and certainly proof that humans have been drinking milk for thousands of years. From an environmental standpoint, the whole industrial milk system is a major source of greenhouse gas emissions and should be avoided, except for those few people who have pasture land to manage their own cows or goats organically and properly. As we know from Alan Savory, whose work has just been featured on Real Time with Bill Maher, proper management of cattle or sheep is one of the few proven tools to take carbon out of the atmosphere and return it to the soil. Industrial milk animals are also abused in many ways and injected with chemicals and antibiotics. I use very few milk-like products myself, and I pour almond milk on my cereal. I don't trust big agribiz meat either, and I don't eat it. Now you have a general idea of what Wardy Harmon means by traditional cooking. Do I endorse all her views? No. Can I learn a ton of things about canning, dehydrating, and organic food prep from her? You bet. I learned how to graft fruit trees from a Catholic nun. Simple YouTube videos produced by Mormon women helped me prepare my food insurance and live cheaper. So far, I haven't become a nun or a Mormon. Learn from everybody. That's my motto. I'm Alex Smith. Let's meet again next week. We'll go out this week with another tune from the Australian band Formidable Vegetable Sound System. From the album Permaculture, A Rhymer's Manual, this is Limits.
Planet, you might know me from such places as the one you inhabit. I'm the air you breathe and the land on which you're standing, the food that you eat. But I'm getting a little bit dark on some of the ways you treat me. Everything you need, yet still you want more. You're falling over yourselves with greed. Yeah, it's time I remind you to exercise restraint. Because if there's one thing you should know, it's infinite I ain't. You better L-I-M-I-T. What you take from me. You've been having a field day on my skin, cutting it up, burrowing in, but I'm reaching for my skin lotion to take away the pain. You better start.